Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Small business ownership is at an all-time low, according to the Federal Reserve. Also, it is getting worse as the percentage of Americans that own a business continues to steadily decline. Knowing that small businesses produce 14 times the patents as a patent-producing large firm, this is bad news for the future of innovation in our country. However, all is not lost. There is one really bright spot that most of us do not see. That is the middle market private equity funds that cater to small to mid-sized businesses. These businesses are solid companies past their startup phase, basically firms that are ready to grow and thrive once they get the needed financing. Today we're talking to Mike McHugh, the managing principal and founder of GMB Mezzanine Capital, a national investment company focusing on the private equity market.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for joining the program.
My pleasure.
Okay, so entrepreneurship is in decline from the government stats, and small firms produce 13 times more patents per employee than large firms. Have you been experiencing any of this through or seeing this personally through the business that you're conducting?
Well, it's interesting. You know, our industry and our fund really focuses on companies that are not startups that have gone one extra step from there. So maybe their operating income has gotten to be a couple million, $2-3 million and up. For companies like that, there's really no shortage of capital. If you can get up to $3-5 million operating income, people like me are banging down your door. I think, though, it is true for people below that. So people to find funding for companies that have yet to make a profit or just barely making a profit, I think they have a much, much harder time finding capital. Funds like ours aren't really playing in that space. Now, if you're a new company, a new product, and you're in something jazzy like a new medical products, maybe there's a lot of venture capitalists that are willing to look at you. But if you're more of a conventional manufacturing distribution business, I think it is really hard for those people to find capital to get some momentum.
But with the mid-size, anything from 2-3 million to 100 million, the money's out there.
Yeah, it's sort of a dichotomy, right? So it's really hard to get started, but once you get started and get some success, there is lots and lots of money out there, much to our chagrin sometimes, because the competition to invest in these companies is really, really fierce. So if you can get up to that level of operating income, there is lots of capital waiting to invest in your company.
And is this because it's a better return on investment than other traditional forms of investing?
Right. You know, our industry, which is often called the private equity industry or the buyout industry, et cetera, probably started really in the late 1980s, and I was lucky enough to kind of start when the industry started. But traditionally, that market has really outperformed the public equity markets, et cetera. And so lots of pension funds, banks, insurance companies, high net worth individuals really like to have a big part of their portfolio or a significant part of their portfolio in the private equity space. So more and more money comes into our space. So more and more people start funds that compete with us, let's say, and there's more money available for business owners.
So are you finding most of your money coming from industry? Are from large pension funds and things like that, or from private individuals?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, and I think it matters what size of fund you are. Everything in life is relative, obviously, and we run right now, our fund is like $240 million, which may seem large, but it's really small when you compare it to the general private equity business. So in our industry, I don't want to get too complicated about it, but it's probably a third institution, so life insurance companies, large banks, et cetera. We do have some pension funds. Those guys usually play in the larger funds, not so much in our size funds. And we have lots of high net worth individuals and family offices. So it's kind of spread evenly among those groups.
So with all that funding, the innovation that these middle-sized companies are having, there's a really good source of money for them to keep building their innovation. Do you look for companies that are more innovative, or do you look for companies purely based on what their profit and that, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and I think it's really changed. I think when this industry started in the late 1980s, everything was talking about, hey, this industry is best fit for companies who are cash cows, so companies that are not growing, companies that are not innovating, but companies that just have, they're generating a whole bunch of cash but don't know what to do with it because they're not really growing. And so the theory was, well, you can put more debt on those companies. That has really changed over the years. So back then, we always looked at, people in our industry looked at the companies that were, you know, generating a lot of cash but weren't spending it on capital expenditures, on growth, et cetera. So they had a lot of cash available to pay down debt and to do debt service. Right now, that's really changed. People in our industry seem to look for growth companies. And so growth companies are really becoming more prevalent in our industry, and companies are seeking them out. What that means is, once you buy them or invest in them, you have to be ready that your investment's not done, right? That you need to keep pumping money into that company so they can build new products, build new locations, build new facilities, et cetera.
So are you looking for more companies that already have a set of established products and they're looking to go into different markets, or are you also looking at companies that have new products and want to put new products out into the market?
Yeah, I think it's both. You know, right now you see a lot in our industry, the money is going for what we call add-ons. So a company, it's called ABC Company, wants to expand, and the easiest way right now to do it is to buy just other companies rather than to, you know, do all the product research development themselves. Go buy a company that's already done that. And so we see in our industry a lot of money going into what we call add-on acquisitions. And so what's interesting about it is, funds like ours used to be just financial people, but as they buy more and more companies, they use those companies, the companies they already own, to buy other companies. So they almost become more of a corporate buyer, a strategic buyer, not just financial buyer.
So they tend to be growing their companies through buying companies versus doing all the grunt work to get it going, which is a lot of work.
Yeah, it sounds like a lazy way of doing it, but it's also smart, efficient, and a smart way of doing it, especially when the markets are like they are now, where it is relatively easy to get capital to make these acquisitions. So in 2009, when our market was basically shut off, it was really hard to get money, for companies to get money. In 2009, the market had just crashed, and everyone kind of brought in their kind of their purse strings were pretty tight. Then to grow, you had to do it organically. But right now, with there's so much money out there and fairly easy to get debt and equity, I think the add-on acquisitions are the way people are growing.
Well, it's also proven, right? You're buying a company that's already have had some success with the product versus organic growth, which is a lot harder, and it's not necessarily going to work.
Right. Right, and I think so. That's sort of the trail now. Is entrepreneurs are building, their companies, and then they are from scratch, and it's not easy. But the ones who are able to do it, they find themselves with a whole universe of possible buyers of their company, because now they've built it to a level that has a, you know, maybe a distinct marketing angle, a distinct product characteristic, something that other companies will want to buy. So if they can get their company up to a level, you know, where other companies want to buy it as an add-on, there's plenty of buyers, and those people who are selling now are really seeing great results because of that.
So is there a pretty good premium on the company? So are they getting traditional 4 to 5, you know, times net income, or are you seeing different kind of valuations?
Yeah, well, we always talk valuations. We always talk in EBITDA, so, you know, it's operating income before you subtract out taxes and depreciation and amortization. It's just one of those acronyms everybody throws around. But we've seen the valuations of those companies has, I'm looking at something in front of me right now that, you know, for companies that say under $25 million that they're worth, those companies in 2010 were worth 5.2, and now they're close to 6. So they've gone up about a full multiple, if you will, of EBITDA. Where even the bigger companies, even prices have expanded even greater. I mean, we're seeing sometimes companies that are going for 10, 11 times EBITDA, which is kind of mind-boggling. And it means it means for those acquisitions to work. When you put it out on paper, it's hard to figure out how they're going to work unless, you know, they're buying them and they're able to take out a lot of costs because they already have a company in that industry, again, an add-on acquisition, so they can take out a lot of costs. or have a lot of synergies between those two companies, because you need a lot of growth to make a 10 to 11 times EBITDA price work. You need a lot of growth to have a 7 times EBITDA growth. And usually, though, in our market, in this lower middle market, which you call it, maybe companies that have revenues of $20 to $70 million, usually you see the valuations in that 6 to 7 times range.
But that's still really good.
It's still really good, yes. And it depends on the industry, right? If you're in a cyclical industry, you're going to get less. If you're in a company that showed in the cycle in 2009 that you didn't get hit very hard, that your sales and profits didn't go down very well, those companies are attracting large premiums if they're selling right now, because companies look at those as, everyone's looking about what did you do in 2009? Did you go down, did your sales go down 30% or did they go down 10%? And the companies who did well during that period of time seemed to be able to earn a very, very large premium when they go out to the market to sell.
Oh, that makes sense to me. I suppose the private equity market makes a lot more sense to me than the Wall Street, because when I invest in different stocks, and I'm so bad at it, because I'll look at stocks and I invested a lot of money in this company that did drug testing, because they grew 20% in 2009. And I kept watching them, and they kept going down, and their stock was just awful. And I couldn't figure out why they weren't – I mean, they grew every year, and they were solid. And then I watch other companies that lost $100 million a year and never made a profit, and they're just growing like gangbusters. And I just figured out, I do not know what I'm doing here. I need to figure out a new strategy. And it seems like the private equity market is just a lot smarter in the way that they go about doing it.
Yeah, what I like about, obviously I have a biased viewpoint of this, since being in the industry. But the thing about the industry, the reason it's worked is really, and we talk about it all the time, is if we buy a company or where we team up with somebody to buy a company, we know that our end game is 5 years down the road, let's say. We're gonna try to improve this company and grow it and sell it 5 years down the road. So we don't care, maybe that's an overstatement, but we don't care if earnings go down in the first few years we own it. If the reason they're going down is because we're building something to get to a higher multiple 5 years down the road. So we'll sacrifice short-term cost and expenses, knowing that the only time it's really going to matter is 5 years down the road. So we can grow a business and not worry that the market's going to react because our earnings went down 10% because we invested in a new sales force. We increased our sales force, so we increased our expenses, and the revenues haven't come in yet because we're just getting that sales force revved up. And so the private equity industry is able to do that without having stockholders and analysts second guessing their every move. And I think that's why the industry works. It does have a longer term viewpoint to value.
Well, and that's super important, because like you were saying, you might not make that much money in the first 2 years because you're really you're funding your expansion. You're funding and it just doesn't work that if you look at companies from only in the short term, you're not going to have long-term growth and stability.
Right. We see that. We see that a lot, and kind of the example I mentioned, we'll see it where it's a closely held company, an owner, the founder still owns it, and it's a really great service or product they're selling, but they just have been, and understandably so, they haven't really spent the money to expand their sales force. Because when you expand your sales force, if you're going to hire 10 new salespeople, that's a pretty scary thing when you own it yourself, because you're increasing your expenses dramatically. And your bank might get, your local bank might get scared when all of a sudden you show your income's going down because you have all these new compensation for these new salespeople. And it takes the salespeople, maybe 1 to 2 years to start getting traction and getting these new orders in. So it's a very scary thing for founders sometimes to spend the money that they should be spending if they really wanted to grow the company. But funds like ours can do that.
Well, and salespeople are notoriously hard to invest in because you don't know. It takes 1 to 2 years, and it's just hard to know who's going to perform. And it's a really difficult.
Yes, it's scary for the founders and understandably so, absolutely.
So being a smaller size fund, do you have a lot more flexibility?
We have flexibility. We invest in debt. We invest in equity. They call us a mezzanine fund because we're in the mezzanine, like in a building. We're between floors, so to speak. So if someone, let's say, is buying a company for $50 million, a normal buyout fund, private equity fund, let's say usually the banks may give them $20 million. It's worth 50. The banks say, "Oh, based on your assets and your cash flow, we'll give you 20." And the fund who's buying it's going to put in 20. So there's a gap of 10 million. We fill that gap, and it can be subordinated debt, which means we're subordinated to the bank. We write an agreement so the bank knows that they're going to get paid before we get paid. Now we get a higher interest rate for that. Or we'll do equity too. We'll do a minority share of the equity. So we have lots of flexibility on each deal, whether we invest in debt or equity, and just do what's right in each case.
So do you, if you're smart and you look at your risk, you end up having a higher profit return, profit
yeah,
margin?
So, yeah, so if you compare us to, let's say, bank, you know, a bond fund or a high-yield fund, because high-yield funds kind of do what we do, but they do it for larger companies that are public, we're going to have a higher return than banks because we've taken more risk. We're further down the capital structure. And we're going to have a higher return than high yield because we're smaller companies and we're private companies, et cetera. Now, we're not going to have the same yield for a successful private equity fund because they're putting all equity and we're having debt. But our results will be more stable through cycles because so much of our investment's in debt rather than equity. And so the debt just performs better, obviously, through cycles than if you were just pure equity. So we're somewhere in the middle of you know, private equity fund, let's say a really good one, let's say invest in that, and you're getting 25% per annum on your investment. And see, if you do a bond fund, you're getting 6%. You know, we're going to be in that more in those teens probably year annual.
And are you consistently in the teens?
I think you're consistently in the teen. Now that's because, but you go through different cycles. So it all matters on vintage years. So if you invest in a fund, whether it be in private equity or mezzanine, and it's in a period of time like now, when prices are really high for companies, and so your investing companies are high, and then 5 years from now you're trying to sell those companies and all of a sudden the market's down, you know, you're going to have lower returns than if you start the fund when the market's kind of soft and you can buy companies cheaper and then you sell those companies when the company's hot like it is right now. So actually what they call vintage year, it's like wine, vintage year, different years are better. Vintage year makes a lot to do with it. I like to think that it's just our intelligence and experience and that makes a difference what our returns are, but a lot of it is vintage year. So when you go out to the market, what cycles you're playing, and when you're buying and when you're selling has a lot to do with it. So it does vary, but I would say, you know, you could expect for like funds like this that on good vintage years you're going to get in the high teens, and for bad vintage years you're going to get, you know, more in that 10 and low teens.
So do you tend to cycle with the market? I mean, is it consistent?
Yeah.
You're not different cycle?
Right, right. And the things that make, I think, allow us to sleep better at night than maybe the venture capitalist or the private equity buyout funds that own a majority and just do equity is that component that most of our fund is probably in subordinated debt. And so having debt just dampens the volatility of your returns through cycles because you have a certain amount that the company owes you back. And if you do your if you do your due diligence correctly, we have all that money below us. Again, in my example, if you're doing a $50 million company and the private equity group's putting 20 below you and you're below and the bank's putting 20 above us, that company would have to degrade in value by $20 million before our $10 million we're putting in the middle there would get hit and show up a loss on us. So we have less volatility in our returns than a private equity fund.
So it's pretty safe. And the companies, you're usually a priority or always a priority for them.
Yeah, yeah. And it's it's not for the faint of heart in that it is, you know, they're smaller companies, they're private companies. Lots of things can happen, but diversification is your big friend, right? So, you know, we're investing in probably around 30 companies for each fund. So there'll be a couple of them in each fund that are kind of clunkers, you know, that don't perform like you want them to perform. But that diversification usually helps you out, and at the end of the day, you're showing really acceptable and attractive returns.
But with being in the middle, even with a clunker, you tend to be okay, right?
Yeah, usually you get you can work through these things. If you haven't, you know, the funny thing that I've learned in this industry is that even if you're in a bad cycle, liquidity means everything. If you have a good basic product or service, and if you have a good management team, if you have liquidity, you can get through those down cycles and then end up on the other side and have a good result at the end of the day. What happens when companies, unfortunately, don't make it through the down cycle is when their liquidity strains. So they have too much bank debt, and the banks put too much pressure on them and close up operations, and they can't pay payroll, et cetera. So it's always very, very important to have liquidity. So you don't want to lever these companies too much, so that when they hit the down cycle, liquidity constrains, and they're just not able to get to that, you know, that shining light on the other end of the tunnel when the market reverses itself.
Well, I think that's an incredible important point, that you can't have them take out so much debt that they can't function. And I think that has been a mistake that a lot of banks and funding resources have done over the last 10 years to a lot of companies.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too. When we look at a company, we look at a lot of it's their just the nature of their business. Some businesses are able to cut their expenses in a down cycle to conserve liquidity more easily than other companies. Companies that have lots of inventory sometimes can, they're a distribution company, et cetera, can constrain that, lower that inventory in down cycles and create cash so they can get to the other side. Some of them can postpone some capital expenditures for a while. Others, however, that are heavy in, let's say, advertising, their business really depends on a lot of promotion and advertising. On down cycles, sometimes when you cut that down to save cash, it starts a death spiral, and you just can't get back. So we also look at fixed versus variable costs. Some companies have a lot of variable costs. So if cycle goes downward, they're able to reduce their costs. Some industries are really based on a very, very high fixed cost, and so when the cycle hits down, they're not able to reduce costs as much, and they really get caught in a liquidity squeeze.
Yeah, that makes sense. So do you look highly at the people who are managing the company?
Yeah, I mean, if there's sometimes what we do is we, you know, hindsight's always 20/20, and sometimes we look back at our mistakes and say, what is the common denominator of those mistakes? And you'd think sometimes it would be, well, the industry, there was a big technological change in the industry, and that's what, and we wouldn't have been able to see that, and that's what caused the problems in that company. And actually, it's rarely that. Mostly it's because we just misjudge management. Management wasn't up to the task. And so in our industry, that's kind of where the art comes in rather than the science, is that you really need to judge these management teams and try to understand how they'll not only perform when things are good, but how they'll perform when things get if they get tough. And there's no sure well, you know, there's no test, written test, fill-in-the-blank test to give managers to understand that. People have tried in the past to do things like that. The best thing you can do is look at management teams, see what they've done in the past, call people who've worked with them, call their capital providers, call their competitors, call their suppliers, call their colleagues, and really figure out what their level of talent is.
I would think that's the most important thing, because even a mediocre business model and product can do a lot better than a great one with the right management team.
Oh, absolutely. And we just have example after example of management teams that have done just fabulous jobs in times of both, wealth and tough times. And there's other management teams that just kind of fall apart when things get tough. So,
well, it's persistence, right? And
yes, absolutely. And, and a lot
it's
of
easy
these,
to fold.
Yeah, and a lot of them are leadership. It's a lot of leadership too, motivating and leaders
yeah.
And people who can attract really good people beneath them, people who feel like they can be their own operators and aren't intimidated by the person above them
yes.
Work scared,
yes.
Et cetera. A lot of these business books come out over the years, and some of them. A lot of them just repeat the same thing. But, I remember the Good to Great books back. I forget how long ago that was. I think those lessons were good. There was really good leaders or fairly humble people, but they're great leaders. People love to work for them.
Well, I just told my class yesterday that sometimes the best leaders lead quietly. They're humble. They're quiet.
Right.
They help. They inspire people in a very quiet manner.
Right. Right. I think it was the Good to Great book, which looked at shareholder letters from CEOs and compared the ones that used I versus the word we. And it was very clear to see which leaders you could put them in one category or the other, the ones that were more of it was about them versus that was about the team. So very interesting.
You know, I use we all the time because it's been hammered into me, probably more by my husband. And when you use we all the time, sometimes you get questions. Well, who's the we, Sarah? Well, I guess it's just me in this case.
The royal we.
Exactly. Okay, so if somebody wanted to get involved in your company and they wanted to be an investor, what size of investment do you usually need for someone to get involved, and you know how does that work?
Yeah, they're pretty usually now. You know, we have funds of many sizes in our industry, but you need to be accredited investor. So, and now I'm going from memory, but the definition of accredited investor, I think, is $1 million or $2 million in net worth, and I think 200,000 net income or 300,000 with your spouse. We, and not to confuse issues, are also an SBIC, a Small Business Investor Corporation. It's a license you get from the federal government. It gives us the ability to borrow from the government at really, really cheap rates to up our yields, et cetera. And for investors in that, it's actually even more, a tougher standard. So our minimum investment in our fund, many funds like this are, you know, maybe $1 million, maybe $500,000. Like in our fund, I think our people invest in our fund, you know, the investment may go from $500,000 to $10 million. Now, they don't always give us that money right up front. So the way our industry, whether it be a mezzanine fund or private equity fund, works is that, let's say you commit to $1 million. We have 5 years to invest that money. So we wouldn't take your $1 million right up front. Every time we would find a deal to invest in, we would then give you notice and say, hey, your $1 million, let's say, is represents 1% of the total fund. We found this deal for $5 million. Please send us, you know, since you're 1% of $5 million, I'm gonna have to, you know, $50,000, send us that check, and so they give us money as we need it, and that's usually how it works. And so usually we're investing people's funds for the first 5 years, and after that, people, you know, companies are getting sold, and then they're getting their money back over the following 5 years. That's a pretty just general. So it's a long, so you do get higher yields, as we talked about earlier, versus, but you're in it for the long game, right? This has to be patient money.
It's a 10-year cycle, usually.
Yes, basically, you got to kind of think of it as a 10-year cycle.
Yeah. And it's a 10-year cycle. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. This is what I heard.
Sure.
It's a 10-year cycle. You need to, your annual income needs to be at least $200,000, $300,000 with a spouse.
Yep.
You need to have,
right.
Your net worth needs to be anywhere, it needs to be upwards of $1 million or more. Is that correct?
I think for just to be an accredited investor, it needs to be $1 million. I think that excludes your residence. And obviously.
And your residence tends to be most of it.
Yeah.
So it has to be separate investments. And then from there, you're going to expect at least a $500,000 investment.
Yeah, right.
Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Because if it's. Go ahead.
Alternative. This is part of all the alternative investment space, right? So if you're, when they talk about alternative investments, so this would be like private equity funds like ours. It'd be real estate. It'd be, you know, oil and gas partnerships, et cetera. So everyone, you know, institutions and individuals, you know, it's proper to have a certain portfolio of your in alternative investments. But just like we say, companies need to be liquid. I mean, individuals should be liquid too. So you wouldn't want to put too much of your net worth in alternative assets because they're just generally less liquid. But that's also why you get higher returns on them, because you're getting paid for that lack of liquidity.
The point of that is to protect the investor, right? I mean, you don't want to take someone that makes $200,000 a year, barely has $1 million worth of assets, and then you're taking everything that they have.
Right. And believe me, I'm sure everyone like me who's a manager of a private equity fund or mezzanine fund feels the same way. We would never want any of our investors to overextend themselves in this category, because we don't want, you know, we don't, if we do have a hard part in the road here, we don't want people panicking and fretting too much. I mean, this is, you need to understand that there's ups and downs in this industry. And over the long run, it has performed really, really well. but in specific cycles, you know, you may need to be patient, and so you need to have it as a proper allocation in your personal portfolio.
That makes sense. Okay, let's get to some exciting things.
All right.
What are some of the exciting activity that you're seeing in the market, in the middle range market?
Yeah. Well, you had mentioned that you looked. It's kind of funny. You'd mentioned you looked at something for a drug test. We've seen a number of companies recently in testing. So whether it be urine testing or blood testing, et cetera, and not just not just the companies that check a worker to see if they're violating some code of using illegal substances, et cetera. But it's more exciting that doctors are using this to see if medicines they're prescribing are being used in the right quantities, if the body's using those drugs in the most efficient manner. So they can test you to see if the pain medicine you are doing is they giving you too less of a dosage or too much of a dosage.
Oh, that's really
interesting. Et cetera. So we've seen a number of companies in that industry. Now, the risk is that it's still a lot of third-party reimbursement, right? So you have Medicaid and Medicare is in a lot of health care. So we see a lot of deals in health care recently. I think people are realizing that with changes in healthcare laws, there's going to be a lot more people covered by health insurance, so they think there's opportunities to benefit from that. At the same time, there's always risk in that sector because you have Medicaid and Medicare represent such a large part of reimbursement, and there's obviously risk of cuts to those programs and reimbursement rates to those programs, et cetera. So a lot's being done in healthcare right now, but you have to have your eyes open.
Are people still really confused as to what's going on? Because I would say the general public is pretty confused as to Obamacare and businesses pretty much confused too.
Yeah, I think they are for individuals, specifically when companies are trying to plan for their individual health care for their companies. But I think other companies that are in providing health care services are seeing opportunities to participate. Looked at a company, companies that provide services to people so that they can stay in their homes rather than be in an institution if they're disabled individuals, et cetera. A lot cheaper for society if they can stay in their homes sometimes and that the medical industry can provide them some basic care there than putting them in big institutions. So plays like that in the healthcare industry where you know that there's common good being done, and so you think that there's going to be a lower probability that the government will slash your funding or Medicaid will slash your funding because it's actually the alternative is much worse for budgets, national budgets, et cetera. So those are the plays people are trying to make in healthcare, I think.
I would think there's so much opportunity in healthcare. When you look at the fact that France is the next most expensive country in the world per person on healthcare spending, we're something like 1.7 times more expensive than per person than France. I would think there's just opportunities endlessly out there for different ways to be more efficient with healthcare.
Right, right. Absolutely.
So how about the exciting things with healthcare? Like, have you gotten involved with any kind of organ growth, or how about some of the research on hormones and how that deals with youth and...
Well, with all sympathies to Joan River fans, we have been involved in a couple of dermatology practice deals, and dermatology has been a pretty big practice, and not just for cosmetic surgery, but for, unfortunately, people of our age that are growing older and been in the sun a lot, skin cancer is a big concern, and so the dermatology practices have really been growing, and we have participated in a couple of investments in that sector. The risk, again, being that those practices, for less scrupulous practices, can take advantage of some reimbursement opportunities and do procedures that really shouldn't be done, do procedures that aren't necessary, and then sort of create the ire of government of reimbursement. And so there's risk in that industry, but there's also great demographic. Demographics are all in its favor as far as baby boomers getting to the age where they need more and more surgeries to solve all the issues they had while sitting out in the sun when they were younger.
Yeah, I think we all know a lot of people who have those issues. It's interesting.
Yeah, some other industries that we've seen a lot lately. It's really interesting. We've seen a lot of pet oriented industries, and there's this term going around humanization, and that the the number of pet owners has grown dramatically, and I had the numbers just a couple of days ago on the top of my head, but I can't remember, but it's grown almost unbelievably. And just people are more and more humanizing their pets, spending more on their pets, et cetera. And we're seeing a lot of that these days. I just a couple of days ago was looking at the number of private equity funds that have gotten into pet foods, either the pet food space, pet toys, pet distribution, pet retail, and it's an amazing number. And so what's kind of interesting, a lot of it on the pet food side is to go like to really high quality ingredients. So one firm that a private equity sponsor invested in recently advertises that not made in China. Remember, you know, everything used to be made in China. This is like not made in China, and stressing that they're making it themselves in the United States, so have more quality control over their ingredients. A lot of companies are going to gluten-free or grain-free dog food. So us humans know a lot of our friends, you know, are gluten-free diets. The same thing is with pets. And I think I read a statistic lately that like it represents like 20-some percent of all now pet food is gluten-free, and it has over a 40% price premium over regular pet food. And so time will tell, but a lot of money going into pet food these days.
Well, and I think when I look at my dog, I mean, this is just my own personal experience. My dog had cancer, and we removed one of her toes, and we think we got it taken care of. But I personally moved to an organic, really important, you know, I really worked hard.
Absolutely.
And I was amazed at how much there really is out there. I think you're right. I also mentored a girl at the University of Minnesota in the entrepreneurial school who was looking at starting a company in and taking care. It was a pet product where the pet owners had a monitor, and when they left, the pet could sense a smell. It would put out their scent, and then they could see the pet on a video, and then they could talk to them, and the pet felt like they were connected with the person because of the scent that it would put out. I thought it was kind of goofy, but interesting enough, there's a lot of people that are just really into that stuff.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And when you see things like that, that really tells you that okay, this is a big market.
Yeah, well, it's so big that now even the mainline like retailers are getting involved. So the Walmarts and the Targets, et cetera, are all getting into pet food, et cetera, because they're just so high margin. People are willing to spend so much for quality ingredients that they're starting to create shelf space for it. So
there's probably a huge margin.
Yeah,
huge margin on that.
Yeah. And we're seeing it also, and obviously in human food too. You know, obviously the move to organic foods and higher quality ingredient foods is attracting a lot of private equity money as well. As well as we've seen a lot in the VMS space, which is vitamins, minerals, and supplements space.
Yes.
So, now some of that we're hesitant on. First of all, we're amazed how many of these companies are extremely profitable. For us personally, we don't want to get involved if we think the benefits that are being touted are illusory or not there, you know. So it's placebo effect at best, sort of thing. So we really will only be interested if we really think these products are really helping people.
Well, how much of that are you seeing where it's just not real?
Yeah, and it's really hard to tell. It's just really hard to tell. So if we can't be convinced otherwise, then we're just going to step away. But we have seen some products lately, and they're commanding huge prices for supplements, for muscle building, et cetera, for vitamins, doctor-branded vitamins, et cetera. And there's controversies on vitamins as well, but there are some really good plays out there. The important thing, though, for us is to make sure that they're legitimate and that we're not just investing in a marketing company, but we're actually investing in a company
exactly.
That has a product that works. Yeah.
Well, I know the whole vitamin deal is going towards whole food vitamins that are based on not synthetically created, but whole food based. And there's a lot of facts out there about that stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, it's an interesting industry, and we're seeing a lot of money going into it. And again, it looks like that a lot of people are being very successful at it. So,
well, there's a big story out there that having the proper nutrition ups your immunities and that keeps you from getting sick. And for people that have changed their lifestyle and really do focus on making sure they have the proper nutrition, it's amazing how much you don't get sick compared to before when you didn't have the proper nutrition.
Right.
So it is. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, it kind of plays to our earlier discussion on healthcare, to investing in healthcare. There's a lot of models being generated in healthcare of, if your healthcare provider has a great economic interest in how healthy you are, they are going to be more active in trying to guide you and educate you to better lifestyle choices on nutrition, et cetera. And, you know, before, a lot of your healthcare providers were not incented for you to be healthy. They're almost incented the opposite,
yes,
right?
Exactly.
The more procedures they perform, the better they were. So we're seeing a lot of that.
How are they being incented to keep you healthy? I don't understand. Because it still seems like they would want you sick. other than having ethics and morality on their side, you know, I want to take care of people and the code of ethics. But beyond that, from a pure business standpoint, wouldn't they want you sick?
Well, no, I think there's, you know, it kind of started when the old HMO came along, and the philosophy is that if you are getting paid, if you can provide your health care providers for a set per, you know, capitation, they call it, a set dollar amount per patient, and you're being paid basically that way, then the less money you spend then on...
Oh, that makes sense.
On procedures, the more money you're going to make. And so you want to do as much. So every time you do a procedure, rather than it making you money, it's going to be taking, you know, it's going to be taking money away from you.
But then does that also encourage having 50 people a day and using kind of the McDonald's drive-through mentality?
Right. Well, that you're absolutely, you know, yeah, healthcare is a very complicated animal. I'm not the guy who's going to solve it. Yeah, I'm just going to look at the business plans of other people who are trying to figure out how to solve it.
You solve one problem and you create another.
Yeah, exactly.
So are you seeing the FDA creating roadblocks for your companies?
You know, that would be more of a, we wouldn't get involved in companies. We probably wouldn't invest in companies that have some sort of FDA issues. Again, that would be more of an early stage company or such a large company that you know, they're doing a lot of research and development. So for our companies, we're probably going to stay away from investing in companies that have a lot of FDA risks, a lot of products under development. We're going to want to invest in companies who have set products and need the money more for distribution purposes or product extensions, et cetera.
How about the manufacturing space? You mentioned to me in the past that manufacturing companies are thriving.
Yeah, I think it's one of the most exciting things happening in the United States today is the current state of our manufacturing base. So for years and years, you know, we've lost manufacturing jobs to China, first to Japan in the 80s and lately to China. And for a long time, it looked really gloomy, the state of the manufacturing sector in America. And anytime we looked at a company, for a number of years, the first question everyone would ask is, what's their China risk? What's the risk that China will take away all their business, that they just won't be able to compete against a competitor in China, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that has changed quite dramatically. And I think part of the reason it's changed is because if you're a manufacturing company based in the United States and you've been able to survive through all that time, it means you're doing something right, right? So it means you have a lot of engineering expertise, or you're very automated, so you don't need the labor, the really cheap labor that China might provide, et cetera. So part of it is that, but part of it is just the manufacturing sector has just had a revival of energy, of innovation and energy into their businesses,
so it's been
really exciting.
Would you say that the companies that were ripe for China to take over have already been taken over, and the companies that are here are ripe for us in the sense of maybe it's engineering innovation, it's knowledge based, it's automated machinery, it's different types of reasons. You need the manufacturer close.
I think it's both. I think part of it is that the ones that were more likely, you know, that China was more likely to compete effectively against have already gone. But I think also it's a change in manufacturing practices here as well. So engineering innovation has been really great here. I'll give you an example. We looked at investing in a company, and we ended up not doing it, not because we didn't want to. It was just because we lost the bid, the company. But it made just a little kind of basic part that goes into HVAC, so heating and air conditioning products. They've been making the product for 30, 40 years, and they transported everything to China, all their manufacturing to China, about 15 years ago, 20 years ago. But we're looking at a film of their China operation. I noticed that everything's automated, so I asked the question. I just go, well, what I'm seeing is everything's automated here. Why be in China? It doesn't seem like you have that much labor content, so why would you need to be in China? They said, you're absolutely right. We would not need to be in China right now. But when we went there 20 years ago, this was a heavy automated, heavy labor-oriented process, and now it's not. Over the last 20 years, it's become so automated. So we wouldn't need to be there now. But since we're there now, and since now they have the expertise, it's not worth our while to bring them back.
And that's kind of sad for the U.S. Yeah, I mean, that's something we have to overcome. That's the knowledge base. Well, China's developing into more of a knowledge base then at that point. They're changing their industry as well.
They're changing, too. So they're changing to be more customer service-oriented. We've seen some companies that have used always China to source their product, but China has just been the source of the product, and then the domestic company, U.S. company, has done all the product development and the marketing, et cetera, and the customer relations, and et cetera. But now we're seeing some of those manufacturing companies in China, now that they've been watching it, they're getting customer service and product development capabilities. Now, that's the bad news. But the good news, well, it's bad for China, but the good news for American industry is that China also is facing a lot of issues in their manufacturing sector. We thought I remember hearing economists tell us for years that there was such a huge migration of rural population in China going to the cities that there would never be any wage pressure in China in the cities in our lifetime, and that's just false. There is significant wage pressure in China. So their wage rates, their labor rates are going up right now. Plus they have huge issues, infrastructure issues as far as, environmental issues, pollution
issues.
Well,
that would make sense. I mean, the whole world is equal, that it's an equilibrium. So there, as it becomes more of a world economy, China's coming up, we're coming down, and then we all rise together. I mean, that's the concept.
Yeah, and it's funny. I remember the 1980s. You probably do too, Sarah. I remember being in, getting my first job in the 1980s working for banks, and the big thing in every business magazine or course you took in college, et cetera, was how the Japanese system was better than our system and that the Japanese manufacturing was going to just overtake us and their Keiritsus and their, everything was better. And it turned out it's not, and their system kind of ran out of steam, and they had the lost 90s of their, what they call it, in their economic growth. And so, the other systems always grow into problems, and the Americans always learn how to adapt. And so it equalizes, it seems.
Well, and we did pick up, let's be honest, in the 80s, our quality wasn't really high. So
it was terrible, right?
It was actually,
we picked up our game.
Yeah, it was actually good for us in that way.
Absolutely.
Our quality increased quite a bit. And Japan's quality demands are pretty high.
Right.
So, but they got other issues. And that cultural issue, it's an issue if your quality demands are so high that it bogs down your manufacturing and your... So they have other issues as well.
Right. And remember in the 80s, though, they were saying how great this Keiritsu system was, where the banks were owning part of the companies, and they were so intertwined, all these companies owned parts of each other. Well, it turned out to be a big... there's always two sides of that knife, and that hurt them when they hit to an economic downturn.
Well, because the governments can't move as quickly. And
right,
the governments
right.
being entwined with all of your businesses is, you just can't move quickly. It's bogged down.
Right, absolutely.
So
the one thing I'm seeing that we haven't seen yet in our market, we haven't seen people develop it to the point where they're hitting our market and saying, invest in us to expand this. But the 3D printing market, I think, is one of the most exciting things going on right now. And that is really going to change
manufacturing, right?
Manufacturing, and I think distribution. I think, I wonder, but, we have, in my career, I've invested in a lot of great distribution companies, and distribution companies that are really well run and had good value added and good margins. And But I'm just wondering if, you know, if I'm in a distribution company and I run a warehouse of all sorts of widgets that when someone needs one, I can send it to them real quick and efficiently. But what if all those companies that are my customers have a 3D printing machine and they need that little product that they don't need very much, they can just download a program and make it themselves. And I just, you know, people in our industry are just, we don't know yet where it's going, how fast it's going to get there, but I think it's going to have a real disruptive effect on some sectors of our
economy. So it's going to start with simple things, and then it's going to start one by one taking over in different areas, I would think.
Yeah.
Someone told me they just saw recently
someone made a miniature car that ran. That was
out of 3D printing.
So it's something that's not yet here yet.
that's pretty interesting.
Yeah. And we were at University of Colorado, and they had in their bookstore a 3D printer working and showed all the products it was making. It was pretty fascinating. It was pretty interesting. But, you know, and we're a long-term investor, so if we invest in a company now, we might not sell it for 5 to 7 years. We got to think not what state of the market is now, but what's it like when we sell. So if we're buying a company now and it doesn't look like 3D printing is a threat, it still may be a problem. What about 5, 7 years now when we're trying to sell this company? Maybe then in that 5 to 7 years will 3D printing be so advanced that it is a threat to our company now and maybe end up depressing the price we get for it, the multiple we get for it. So we have to think, even though it doesn't seem like it's knocking down our door right now, we got to be thinking about it.
Well, and I think the obstacle with that would be the technology on the printer side.
Right.
You know,
right.
Because if there's certain materials that are special that they have to put into it,
yep,
versus being simple. And so there's certain industries that are a lot more vulnerable than others, I would think.
Right.
Well,
go ahead, Tara.
No, go ahead. You got another cool example.
I was just going to say in the manufacturing sector, we recently sold a company we just had a great experience with, and it kind of reminded me of manufacturing in the United States, too, is that this company made something they were using technology that was 50 years old. They basically, it's called expanded metal. They punched a hole in the metal and then kind of expanded it. So it kind of looked like a mesh, like a screen mesh, but it had different properties to it than if you just punch a hole in something. Old machines have been around for 50 years. Traditionally, the products have been made for kind of been used in batteries and using some old products, etc. We invested in the company with the private equity, another private equity fund. That private equity fund that we invested in brought in as a chairman an ex General Electric executive. Engineer, great R&D, new product guy. He came in, revamped, reinvigorated the whole product development and research and development staff. Now, you might think, you know, back to our earlier conversation when we said, what was the typical, like, buyout deal you used to do? Well, you used to invest in companies. That would be kind of the old cash cow. This company didn't need much capital expenditures. They're using the same machines it made for 40 years. You could have bought that company and just kind of milked it, right? Milked the cash flow, not invest in it for growth, and probably done okay. Matters what price you paid for it. But it's kind of a no growth, but kind of a steady company. But instead, this private equity sponsor and this new management team comes in, spends a lot of money on investing in new people and R&D and product extensions. And they end up with the same technology, but a whole different product and product applications. For example, the jet airliner that you get in and fly around in used to be all being made of aluminum, and now they're being made of this new composite material that's much, much lighter. Well, that's good news. The bad news is that if lightning hits your airliner, traditionally the lightning would be dispersed over the body of the airline. With these new composite materials, it'll blow a hole right through the fuselage. But don't get worried. There's a happy ending. The happy ending is that this company that we've invested in made a product out of this expanded metal that goes underneath that composite material that's a lightning protection for the airplane, and got, you know, through Airbus and Boeing, got specced in on all their new jets, and so it was just a huge win for them. Now, if they hadn't invested in those new R&D guys, the product extension guys, instead would say, well, we have an old technology, we're just going to kind of milk the cash as long as we can get it, we would have never been able to capitalize on that opportunity.
Well, it's just so interesting because new innovations bring on new problems and it brings on new opportunities in business.
Right.
And that's why you want innovation in a market, because that's where all the growth happens. And you need to educate people and really have the whole engineering thing, and you want more kids going into that so we have a more knowledge-based society. But what do you think?
Right.
Okay, I'm going to get really shallow.
Okay.
And I talked to you about this before, about the beauty industry. $1 in $3 was spent during the Great Depression on beauty. And during a depression or a recession, it's the one industry that really has strong growth. People flock to that for some reason, when they probably to all try to reinvent themselves during a hard economic time.
Mm-hmm.
But so it's immune to fluctuations. But in that industry, there's machines that they're putting out that, well, the FDA is looking at non-surgical liposuction machines, which actually is a health factor because if you can get rid of a lot, we're obese in this country. I mean, we really are. If you go to France and you see how thin people are, and you come here and you see how large we are here, it really is a health epidemic. But The FDA found that 70% of people that use these machines, these non-surgical liposuction machines, have significant results. And what it's really doing is it's pulling the toxins and fat out of the stuff in your fat cells and pulling it out, and your liver is then digesting it. But they have these machines in China that aren't that expensive, that deal with all sorts of things. It does the liposuction, it does the hair removal, it does the age spot removals, it does the wrinkle reduction, it does all these things. And it really hasn't hit our market yet. It's starting to really hit in Europe and different places. And these machines are actually starting to really work. Have you seen any of that stuff? And what do you think about that?
No, we haven't. Fascinating. And I'm wondering why you're bringing it up, looking at me, but I don't know if you're trying to tell me something. But
I am trying to tell you something.
All right.
No,
all right,
I'm kidding.
No,
I've been looking at it for some companies I'm working with in Mexico and some various things. I'm looking at these machines, and we can actually brand them ourselves and so forth. But I'm just fascinated by it because I just see it as a huge market.
Yeah. Yeah. As I said, you know, we have some investment in dermatology, and some of it is you know, serious skin cancer. But some of it is beauty related, cosmetic related as well. And
it's shallow. It's vain.
It can obviously be overdone, but there are parts of it that are fairly interesting. They showed me once. I was going through, and they showed me for hair transplant. So in these offices, they can do hair transplants for men or women who need more hair on top. And what they do is they take hair from the side of your head, which is genetically apparently less likely to disappear. It's just there's a different DNA. I may be misstating this scientifically, but this is why I came away from the conversation. So the hair on the side of your head has different DNA than the hair on the top of your head, and is will not go away usually on the side. So they take those hairs and they split them. They take hairs from your own head and they split them, you know, very microscopically into make one hair, and I'll just make up a number because I can forget what it was, into 10 hairs. And then they insert them one by one on the top of your head, and those will grow.
And they probably won't have problems falling out because the DNA is different.
Right. And so they don't fall out. And so, but it is, as you can imagine, a very, very long process. So they have extremely big, comfortable chairs and lots of VCR tapes.
Well, okay. Well, let's face it. Right now, this is really for a luxury and for the wealthy. But if they can get the price down where you just go in and get a tune-up, you know what I mean? Like a car tune-up. You're let's say it's $60 for an appointment, and you get all your wrinkles and you get your hair, and you it's very quickly done in an hour thing. They touch up all the things that you want to have touched up and leave. That could be an absolutely huge industry.
Yeah, it could be. Now, part of me, I kind of split feelings on that. Part of me sees how graceful Paul Newman, Joanne Woodward.
I know.
I'm wondering why can't everyone just do that? But
well, you know. the vein part, you're right, and there is beauty to aging. But like this liposuction stuff, I actually see that as a huge health.
Yeah, no, that's more of a health, absolutely.
Huge health advantage.
Yeah,
cause,
absolutely.
You know, the people that do it for vanity reasons, it's actually not healthy to take fat cells out of your body. You want to keep the fat cells you have because otherwise you're just going to gain weight in other areas. It's really unhealthy to take that out, and they've had lots of medical problems with that. So if you have a non-surgical option for people that they can use in their own home on a regular basis. Now, that might encourage eating like crap, which is another issue, but it really could, it could be a real benefit for people.
Yeah, well, but that's interesting.
It's still vanity. You're talking to a girl. I'm really vain. Oh, well. Okay, so if people want to get involved in your company, you can provide me with the information, and I can put it on our website.
Sure.
Your contact information, and also if they have a business that wants funding, if they're a $2-3 million or larger company that needs mezzanine funding or additional capital, you would be a really good source to talk to.
Yeah, we always encourage people, even if we're not the right fit, we usually, if people have a need for capital, I'm more than happy to talk to them and see if I know someone who is a better fit for them. So, you know, that's the fun part of our job, is to talk to people who are entrepreneurs and building businesses, and where we see all sorts of industries. So we know enough to talk about lots of industries in a cocktail party, but not enough to run any of them. But,
but you're educated in so many things. It's so cool.
So we're great at cocktail parties. You can always invite us there. We'll be interesting. But I would love to do that. And
okay,
I really appreciate
great.
The time talking today. I thought it was really fun.
Yeah, this was great. Thank you so much for talking to me today.
Okay, Sarah.
Okay, talk to you soon.
As you heard, the private equity market is exciting. Many new innovations and exciting things are happening that will change the business landscape. 3D printing could completely revolutionize how cars are made, how distribution is accomplished, and it may even revitalize the manufacturing industry in the United States. Another promising and busy sector is the healthcare industry. Changes in government policies and continued advances in technology are creating all sorts of new business opportunities in this sector. If you want more information on how to get involved with Mike's firm, his contact information will be included on this show's website, along with a link to his company's webpage. That's it for now. Have a wonderful day.